Good morning. My name's Aaron Gladwell. It's good to be with you this morning. Special welcome to those who are new. I know we say that every week, but I feel like I want to say it every week, just so anybody who's here, who's in that space of I'm not sure why I'm here or what I'm doing here, knows that you're really welcome. I wanted to start with a story. I was a teenager. I was walking home from church, and it was a big crowd of us. So there was my family, that's all six of us, and then there were at least half a dozen others. They were all coming over for, you know, big mashed potato lunch. And so about a dozen of us walking up this main street of the little town of Sioux Center, Iowa, which is where we were living at the time. Chatter, laughter, is surrounded by people who knew me. And I don't know what prompted it, but a friend who was a bit older, who I actually serendipitously got to catch up with after over a decade just this weekend, which is interesting. I love how that kind of thing happens. But this friend who's just a bit older turned to me and said, "Are you feeling lonely?" I was in a pretty, like, you know, teenagehood. I was in a pretty cynical, guarded space, even though I was having fun. So, and I was in a really sarcastic stage. So I said some quip like, "Yeah, totally lonely. Look all the people around me," you know, like. And he took that in, and then very warmly, wisely, simply just said to me, you don't have to be alone to feel lonely. And that moment stuck with me. In the moment, it was super uncomfortable. I was like, do not see me. Do not see me. And also, thank you so much for seeing me. You know, like those two things warring inside of me. And it stuck with me for 30 years because I think in that moment, something was very, like, was viscerally true for me. And deep inside had been seen, and I was just desperate for that to be seen. And I was also so afraid of that being seen by anyone. Those two things were at war in me. I longed to be understood deeply and really afraid of what would happen if they found that part of me. And it's not the first time, and it's not the last time I've had that experience. I see a few of you nodding. I spoke a bit about it with some younger people in my life recently, and they were like, yep, totally get that. That is my experience all the time. It's, I think, this disconnection or alienation that profoundly shapes our human experience and our desire to be known and to know, and then having that being regularly thwarted by our inability to be vulnerable or to be honest or, you know, trying to, and then causing hurt and just for whatever reason these attempts go awry. We're in a series on healing origins, is what the title of the series is. And we're looking at Genesis 1 to 11. And we're asking in what ways these passages, so today it was Genesis 2, in what ways these passages were healing for earlier listeners. I'm so sorry, there's a buzzing behind me that's going to distract me this whole time. I think it's my husband's bass. So turn that off. Thank you. Yeah, that's good. Okay. Okay. So, we're talking about Genesis 1 to 11. In what ways are these passages healing for earlier listeners and for us today? And today's largely going to be about us today. But Nelson took us to the topic of work and rest last week. I encourage you to check that out on the podcast. If you're interested in thinking about work and rest and how we heal our relationship to those things, that rhythm. And today we're looking at Genesis 2, and we're looking at the topic, welcome visitors, the topic of sex and sexuality. And in a moment, I'm going to offer a definition of sexuality, but just so you know, and like if you've got any tension that immediately rises in you, the way I'm thinking about it is very much in terms of the story I just told, right? It's about that created goodness in us that desires to connect and be known. And also that in our bones alienation and disconnection that just can't seem to quite do that with one another. And that clashing that leaves us alone. So if you've got questions, that's okay. I'm going to say more in a minute, but I first want to say a bunch of things to frame this sermon, and I think you probably understand why I want to do that. As we put together this Healing Origins series, it seemed really important to take up the topic of sex and sexuality, in partly because that's a piece of our lives that really, in all of us, needs healing. also because of how central Genesis has been in debates in Christianity around this. Also because more than one person at Arzen has said to me, I wish we could talk about this stuff more openly, but it's really hard, and it is, it's really hard. I'm terrified to be up here. So as today approached, I realized I really did not want to preach this sermon, despite feeling like it had been a good idea back when we made this this series. And last night, in revision mode, I realized part of the reason I didn't want to preach it is because I haven't been here for long in this community. And once something is said from the front, it becomes a part of our shared story, no matter how much it's hedged, right? And I feel like we're still in a learning phase as a community and a building trust phase. I feel like I am personally in a phase of still hearing stories, learning people's stories, knowing where this touches down. And it takes actually a long time to get to the point where you trust enough to even talk about these things, if you ever do, right? So I'm still listening to people's stories. I'm still listening, I think, for myself. How is Jesus good news for our lives as sexual beings in this community? I'm aware of a few other things, though, that I want to say. First, it doesn't matter what we're doing, but the higher the vulnerability, the more careful you have to be. And it doesn't matter, it doesn't get much more vulnerable than this, right? Talking about what it means to be sexual. That feels high risk for you and for me. Let's be honest. Secondly, sex and sexuality is one of the major areas of harm in the church, just as it is in the broader culture, because of what a vulnerable personal thing it is, right? The potential for harm is so high. So part of me has been asking all week, what right do I have to say anything at all? And part of the problem in church conversations about sex is that we've elevated these conversations above all sorts of other ethical decisions that we make. So for some of us, we feel like this is the one pathway to God. This came out in a conversation with a couple of staff this week. It's the one pathway to God, and we're either getting it right or messing it up permanently, right? And so it's kind of like a really high-stakes conversation for some of us. And so part of the healing, I think, is to lower the stakes and be human about it, and yet at the same time, increase your care because of the high risk, right? So you see that, those two sides of like, let's lower the stakes, and also let's be super, super careful. So it's a bit of a mess. And lastly, I'm aware of the difficulty both in generalizing and in getting too specific, right? Both ends are tricky. So that means I'm not likely going to say the one thing you really don't want me to say, and I'm also probably not going to say the one thing you really want me to say. You know, both ends. Generalizing is difficult, too. Partly because I'm 85 to 100% sure, that the creation stories of Genesis 1 and 2 were not told to answer the questions who, when, how, and for what purpose should I have sex. I don't think that's what they were written to answer, and especially not in our context, in the specifics of what we deal with today. It's not terrible to try and draw general conclusions from these stories, and stories can mean more than the one thing they were intended to mean at the beginning. I love that about scripture, the power of story. But as someone said to me in conversation last week, we have to just be honest with ourselves that that's what we're doing. We're grasping after partial understanding, always. And today is a Sunday when I remember that really, really clearly. In the case of the creation narrative, we're creating meaning that probably wasn't the original purpose. So what questions was it told to answer? I come back to that. Questions like, who is God? What is God like? What are human beings? What are we like? What's our purpose? What's the character or the spirit of our relationship with the world, with God? How do we relate to the rest of creation? How do we relate to extraterrestrials? No, that is not in there. Okay, but when I consider these questions, in Genesis 2, the previous ones, and our conversations around sexuality, I feel like there are some things that I can say, and I can just offer them. And so my hope is that you can take these human thoughts and engage with them yourselves, and discern with those you trust, because I think discerning communally is really good around this stuff, right? But maybe not at this scale, for your own personal life. So take what you can and discern with those you trust what it means for you. And I am happy as a pastor to be a dialogue partner for some of you, if that's helpful for you. So that's my extended framing of this sermon. And I felt like it needed all of that. And if in this moment you still feel tension, or you know, you're like, I think at some point I'm going to be leaving this room because I don't really want to talk about this, that is totally fine. But let's just take a moment. And if it's helpful for you, just notice if you've got tension in you. I often breathe into that tension, but do whatever you think is helpful. And then I'm going to just offer a prayer, largely for myself, but for all of us, into the quiet. God, please grow our trust of one another and of you, and our ability to talk about vulnerable things in ways that are appropriate and helpful and move us forward on our paths of healing and faith in you. And please, in your wisdom, sift what I say, sift what everyone hears individually, and do that mysterious work that your spirit does of doing whatever work needs to be done, kind of to the side and around and in between what it is that we're actually saying. We trust you to do that work. Amen. Okay, Genesis 2. So Gordon Wenham, who is an Old Testament theologian, somebody that Mark, my husband, studied with for a little while as well in the UK, when he writes about Genesis 2, he names three themes like throughout this chapter, and they were surprising to me. They were food, authority or dominion, and sexuality. And I that last one is especially surprising because I don't see what I might recognize as, you know, a sexual encounter or something in this chapter. So it makes me ask, what's he seeing in this passage that is about sexuality? You might think he's referring to the final line, Genesis 2, where it references marriage as an example and says, okay, this is the way some people will leave their parents and they're going to attach to their spouses, they're going to make marriage covenants together. So, and for sure, that's part of what's going on in this passage. That's part of where we find sexuality. But it's not enough for that to be, it's not a theme throughout. That's the only spot. So I think there's more we can glean here. And in order to do that, I think it's important to broaden our curiosity and ask a more basic question, which is, what are we even talking about? Like, what is sexuality at all? You know, we can think of, and you probably did when you heard we were going to talk about this, immediately thought of specific things. Like, are we going to be talking about this, that? Like, specific behaviors, right? Or ways of relating. But so many of those can all be kind of gathered into a category that is about sexual things. About what makes them all belong together? What is that? What's the common thread? A wide variety of theologians, even theologians who disagree on many other aspects of this debate, kind of agree that a biblical understanding of sexuality, what's at the core of it, is this desire for connection, right? Sexuality is our desire to bond with that which is beyond us. Deborah Hirsch, Mennonite church leader, I believe, I don't know very much about her, but she defines it as the compulsion to connect. Sarah Coakley, who's an Anglican priest and a leading theologian on the Trinity, says sexuality is kind of a more modern word, and what we're talking about is desire. This is more fundamental, desire for connection. And then Ronald Rollheiser, a Catholic mystic, so we've got a Mennonite, an Anglican, a Catholic, there's also a Baptist who says the same thing, writes, it's the energy inside of us that works incessantly against our being alone. That's kind of at the core of it. So I don't know if you buy that or not, but I do. I kind of, as I read through, it makes sense to me. To continue with Ronald Rollheiser for just a minute, he says, when you see any person who in a moment of service, affection, love, friendship, creativity, joy, or compassion is for that moment so caught up in what is beyond them that for that instant their separateness from others is overcome, you're seeing sexuality in its mature bloom. I love that. I think that's so radical and beautiful. It really opens up the conversation. I think the quote is a reminder that it's this discussion around sexuality, which is often very guarded and it's only for certain people in certain types of relationships, is actually for all of us. And that this reality of being sexual, of longing for that connection, belongs to all of us, regardless of relationship status, orientation, gender. So Rollheiser's phrase, about, it's not, the phrase that where he was defining sexuality, the energy inside of us that works incessantly against our being alone, I think really echoes this phrase in Genesis 2. It's kind of a haunting phrase, and it can feel a little bit, I think it can feel like it can hit wrong some days, where it's not good or complete for the human to be alone. But let me just say a little bit about it. So verses 4 to 15, God takes this human, puts him into the garden, into Eden, a specific place where the rivers are named, the kind of resources that exist below the surface of the earth's crust are known, a place that exists in relation to everything that is west of it, right? It's got a geographical relationality. The human's flourishing depends on the flourishing of this place. They're interconnected. The human body and its goodness relies on everything around. We've talked about this a few times in the lead up to this. And humanity's flourishing in this moment is also shown to be dependent on God's presence. And we see that in the water. That's actually, there's a symbolism there with the water of the springs in verse 9 and the rivers in verses 10 to 14, these symbols of God's life-giving presence. My friend Jody pointed out the other day at our neighborhood group a couple of weeks back, actually, that her indigenous friends point to this interrelatedness as the content of the word goodness in Genesis. It's interesting, after we preached on goodness a couple of weeks ago, a lot of people talked about goodness. It was like several, like, what does goodness mean? What do we mean when we say everything's good? And at that neighborhood group conversation, that conversation opened up into this idea that goodness of creation is actually its completeness, and the completeness is created by these interrelations. So that's what's good. And before sin even enters the picture in this narrative, this moment of original goodness, God has a nagging feeling that something more is needed for the Adam, the first soil creature. Right? Remember, Adam, it means, it's kind of like a play on words to relate humans to the soil. Something's more is needed for this Adam to completely flourish. So verse 18, it's not good for a person to be alone, God thinks, watching this one, and literally just one. So let's bring something into this little garden that can offer companionship to this one. After having heard so many times that creation is good, it's good, it's good, and then it's the moment before sin enters, it's like, this is not good. Like, oh, right, it's not because it's morally bad. It's just because it feels incomplete, right? That there's more to be made yet. Aloneness isn't good. And I feel like that's for all of us to hear. The community of creation already existed, right? But there is still this desire for connection. And I'm going to say a bit more about this, but I just want to note that I don't read this as a movement from singleness to marriage. It's not how I read this text. I don't think that's what's going on here. This is a movement from only one to a full human race or full human community. So the next two verses create a little suspense in the narrative. Which is kind of fun. You can imagine it dramatized, where God brings animals to the human to see if any of these will do, right? What about the rabbit, cows, you know, the peacock? Is there anything here that can, like, do it for you? Like, are you excited about these creatures? Oh, there's too many innuendos in this sermon. I'm sorry. That was, again, welcome visitors and apologies. So the human creates connections with all of them, names them, gives them a place in Eden's community, but no suitable helper was found. So you notice how God is, I actually love this, God is depicted as giving the choice to the human. It's like, you know, I'll give you some options and you discern. You're going to know. You're going to know when you found true companionship. When Nelson was talking last week about work, talked about three sort of parts to being human, where there's vocation, there's permission, and there's prohibition, and those all kind of fit together. And this is a moment of permission. You know, it's like, here are the animals. Can you find a companion here? And the phrase, no suitable helper was found, is the answer. It's a tricky one. Helper has a connotation of being weaker, subservient, right? And perhaps you've heard this, but the Hebrew word there, aether, is used elsewhere, actually describe God's relationship to humanity, God as ally to human beings. And in the Psalms, it's actually used in military context, like someone who comes to the aid and saves you. So there's a real power, actually, in this term, and it's more about what they are doing for one another, as opposed to some sort of hierarchy here. So there's that piece, just to say. And then this one human has now found that they don't have what they need, so we need to find this helper. God puts the soil creature to sleep, does surgery. I've heard it so many times since childhood, but every time I hear it, it's kind of like, what an interesting story. And in order that a new creature can be made out of the very same material as Adam, it's taken from his side. And remember Adam, I say him, but this is Adam. This is the first human being who is just representative of humankind. And carefully crafts another soil creature. And this first human's just ecstatic. You see the outburst in verse 23 of like immediately recognizing this second human being for what they are, right? This is someone with the same capacities as me. It's not the cow. This is me again, you know? This is a moment of recognition, someone who could be my companion. It's about sameness, actually, and the strength of human community in this moment. It's not the birth of marriage, it's the birth of human community. And then there's an aside about, and see, this is the application to how we're doing marriage, right? So this is a moment where you have the birth of human community and companionship. There's been a lot of fascinating scholarship on the bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, that I'm not gonna get into, but if you're curious, come and ask. All I wanna say about that is, we have, this is the language of covenant and kinship. So it's like saying, when I say my sister is my blood relative, it's like that depth of like connection. We are family now. So this is like the birth of one human family. There's no separations. There are no different species. We are one family. And there's a covenant, and the covenant is a sort of promise between parties that's held by a larger community. So it's this moment of like, Adam seeing his counterpart and having this sort of like, we're family now with God kind of as a witness. What else to say about that? I think, you know, we do have this after this aside following. So this is why we do marriage the way we do. And I think that often is kind of seen as, oh, and there, it's etiological, right? It's the, now I'm going to explain to you why marriage came about. But there's no separating out of the species of human in this moment where the soil creature becomes family, becomes multiple. I think it's hard to see this in part because of the names as Adam and Eve. The way we've thought of them or the way we hear them now, we think of them as like the name of an individual human male in really strong terms. So Adam gets lost, that pun that's there. And even Eve, which means living or life, that symbolism gets lost. And we just think, oh, it's like, you know, Dave and Sheila. Well, no, it's like soil creature and life. That's the symbolism here, right? And as the soil creature comes into community, it's brought to life. I think this soil creature label is really important to remember and to hold intention here, right? Intended to underline the connection between humans and the soil. And yet to say there's more needed. That wasn't enough. I think finding the desire for connection fulfilled in human community in this story, that this is what's happening, it's human community being birthed, gives me a wider, freeing scope for this conversation, where it doesn't matter your relationship status, it does not matter the quality of your sex life. We are all of us needing to be drawn out beyond ourselves to intimacy with another. We have that feeling Adam had of, this doesn't feel good, this alienation. We're to some extent alone and unable to find that connection. Rollheiser puts it in a really great way. Sex is a wide energy. We are healthily sexual when we have love, community, communion, family, friendship, affection, creativity, joy, delight, humor, and self-transcendence in our lives. And this line, I think, is beautiful. Having these, as we know, depends on many things and not just on whether or not we sleep alone. I've had a few interesting conversations with friends where I rudely ask them if they had a time in their life when they ever felt sexually whole. I recommend it. It's an interesting conversation. And fascinatingly, in a few of those conversations, just noticing the theme that it had nothing to do with sex for them. It had to do with being healthier by living in relationship with a broader community, single and families living together, like finding that sense of wholeness in community. And so I think the richness of this passage in Genesis 2 suggests that all sorts of relationships, like there was relationship, there was community even before the woman was created, right? That all these relationships make up and foster healthy sexuality. And if you fast forward to the New Testament, there's a bit of a shift in the language where community is described now in terms of fellowship around Christ. So it's a bit of a different image than the kinship of like blood relation in humankind. But now there's kind of a new humankind that's birthed as we center around Christ. We become kin, or we choose to become kin with one another. Promise to stick it out. Okay, the last line in this chapter, Adam and Eve were both naked and they felt no shame. We haven't yet hit the part of the story where sin comes in, but before anything mars this wholeness, we see this final line that tells us the first two humans stood in the garden completely vulnerable and they were at peace. They were unashamed of who they were. And I thought, imagine that, and I thought, I don't know if you want to imagine that, but like imagine it as a feeling that you could feel completely unashamed of yourself and totally at peace with how you've been created. And if you grew up in a tradition that tried to separate like spirit and body or soul and body and say one is better than the other, this is an especially important line for you to just dip into. To notice bodies as part of the original goodness, which means desire is part of the original goodness. I think it's a really clear declaration. Embodied life is good, nothing to be ashamed of. And yet, as I walked down the main street as a teenager, surrounded by people, I felt alone and I felt ashamed. And I think we can see the answer to why in Genesis 3. If you scan Genesis 3, 14 to 19, and you just notice all the places where connections are getting broken, it's really interesting. That's what the fall is. It's this disconnection between the humans, disconnection between humans and the lands, disconnection between the creatures and the land and the humans, between God, right? It's all this alienation, breaking of shalom, the tearing apart of that goodness, that complete interrelated whole. I think in the fall, we've just become alienated in our very bones, alienated from ourselves and from our bodies, alienated from creation, alienated from one another, alienated from God. Creation is alienated. We don't even have to choose. Like, this is not a moral choice we make. I'm going to. We are. We just are. There's something, some intimate connection that's missing and that's going to be missing for all of our lives. Again, I'm going to return to Rawlheiser, who has a great chapter on this. I don't agree with everything that's in that chapter, but there's a lot of really good stuff to chew on in there. In this world, there is no such thing as a fully consummate joy. We are always in some way frustrated, in some way sleeping alone, whether we are having sex or not. And I think our attempts to reconnect are often part of the problem. Like we, is there one part healthy, one part harmful? The one part about loving a person and also one part about loving ourselves or feeling insecure or, you know, whatever it is. And God's response here, and I feel like there's a bit of a symbolic thing we can carry into the present day, is to clothe us and to provide some separation and privacy, right? The clothes are this, like, symbol of separation, a representation of our separateness as a way of protecting our vulnerability. The clothes are necessary because we're alienated, and then because we make harmful choices out of that alienation, both. And we try to reconnect at the expense of other people. We make sexuality more about violence or power or narcissism than about vulnerability. So then clothes become necessary and continue to be necessary. And child protection policy is necessary. And communal covenants and marriage becomes necessary, and relational boundaries become necessary, and processes for justice become necessary, because we all have in us this deep need to connect, and we are always messing it up. We no longer have this privilege of just constant vulnerability, intimacy with one another and with God. So if the renewal of all things, which is what Artisan's mission statement is, includes our sexuality, then maybe this looks like, and here's where, you know, take it how you'd like, where do you want to take this, but maybe it looks like protecting each other's dignity and vulnerability, when we see that being erased. Maybe it means sitting with each other in loneliness, right? Acknowledging being allied in loneliness. Perhaps it's claiming our own brokenness without shame. Perhaps it's operating by rules of respect and consent so that we don't violate others. But take this where you will in terms of your own thinking. I began with a story from my teen years. I wanted to be known. I wanted to be connected. I had no idea how to get over that barrier of alienation. And I'm still like that. We're all still like that a bit. And that small, kind gesture of my friend, I think, provided me with just a bit of a mirror. I didn't really want to look in, but gave me this mirror to look into. And I did. I glanced at it. And I didn't choose to say the truth in that moment. But I think hearing someone else say it out loud broke down a bit of my resistance to claiming that truth myself. And I think it brings me to this, I think it's the last quote that I'm going to give you from Rollheiser. But what we really need is, and I just, this feels like where I want to land, is precisely a confessor. Someone before whom we can stop having to lie. And someone before whom we do not have to try to measure up. And someone who can console us from the fact that we cannot not disappoint them. Because even at its best, the love we give each other is not enough. We know the goodness of community deep in our bones. We know we can help each other with this, right? We can help create wholeness together. We also know deep in our bones that salvation is not in this room in terms of the human beings that are around us, right? It can never be community. Perfect community doesn't exist. We're too flawed. We're too self-involved. We need a confessor. And I'll speak for myself. I need God as my confessor. We need someone before whom we can stop having to lie, and someone who we can console us because we can't actually disappoint them in any way. We can disappoint others. We can't disappoint God because God already knows that the love we give is not enough. And God's love is sufficient to mend that breach. So we've broken our covenants in this room. We've perpetuated violence. We have tried to be self-sufficient, and we've become bitter, and that's just the truth of us. But somehow we're still God's beloved, and this is what I think is so beautiful, is that as we receive that love, the overflow then becomes something that we can offer to ourselves and offer to others. And it does not come out of any sort of self-sufficiency or ability to mend that breach, right? Okay, I did not expect to get emotional, and I hope that's okay in this moment. This is by no means all that needs to be said about sexuality, right? There's a million things that still need to be said and that we need to say for ourselves and figure out for ourselves. And I've only been here a year and a half in this role, and it still feels like a time of learning and listening. But I do think we have been in this world long enough to know that this conversation is best held in the love of the Creator. And that as we move between connection and disconnection, that being held gives us a sense of hope. So we'll close there and we'll come to the table now. Before we do that, I'm just gonna give you a moment of quiet. If you wanna jot down or just kind of solidify for yourself, if there's something in this conversation that feels like, I want to chew on that more, I want to take that back with me, or if there's something there that raises the question, you think, I'm not sure about this, I need to think about this more, I need to talk to someone about this more, I'm just going to give you a minute to do a bit of that integration within your own mind and just let it settle, and then we'll come to the table.